Just a few months ago, more than 500,000 Americans were working for the U.S. Census. That helped to prop up the job numbers in this economy. But as the 2010 census winds down, most of those jobs have disappeared. And many former census takers are looking for work in what is still a tough labor market. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McGammon reports from Des Moines.
Teresa Brown's census job came along at just the right time. She was working before, running a home daycare, but after her son James was shot to death a week before his 22nd birthday, she says she could no longer muster the patience to work with children all day. That's when Brown went to work as a clerk and later a recruiter for the U.S. Census.
It really made a big difference to get out and around people. It really helped calm my nerves. I was able to stay focused.
Brown is 44, a short, round woman with bright eyes and hair pulled back behind her head. She and her husband are raising 5 grandkids, all aged 6 and younger, including 3 of her son's children.
Okay, you guys want your cheese and crackers?
Yeah.
All right.
On a weekday afternoon, the kids turn cartwheels, toss around a ball, and snack on crackers and bologna sandwiches in the large kitchen.
Thank you, Mommy.
Brown has had more time with them since her census job ended at the beginning of July. She's applied for office work and had a couple of interviews, but nothing has come through yet. Her unemployment benefits have run out. Brown's husband is in poor health and can't work, so the family is living with relatives. 57-year-old Kevin Schroeder had been out of work since losing an advertising job almost 3 years ago, until the census hired him as an interviewer in April. He says that provided a welcome break from unemployment.
For as long as I've been out of work, that is probably something that really maybe grates on a person the most, is when you wake up in the morning, you don't have to be anywhere.
Schroeder is back to that feeling and the job search since his position ended in mid-August. Most census workers have been let go, and offices across the country will shut their doors completely by mid-November. As workers head back out into the labor market, they're up against sluggish job growth and national unemployment rates still well above 9%. Steve Langrud is a career coach and works at DePauw University in Indiana.
I think what people are finding is that the competition is still stiff, that there's still a lot of people looking for work, that there probably are not as many opportunities as they had hoped there would be, thinking, well, by the time I'm done, there'll be a much bigger uptick in opportunities that we probably haven't seen.
But Langrud says former census employees have at least one advantage, a recent work history. Teresa Brown hopes her experience will position her to be hired soon. She says when she has too much free time, she finds herself thinking more about her son's death. And she longs for a permanent home for the children.
Their thing is that, well, Grandma, when are we going to get in our house? When do we want to go home? So that's why I really want to get back into the workforce so that we can all get up underneath our own roof and continue to live like we had before.
For now, with the census just another line on her resume, Brown says she's trying to hold on long enough to land that next job. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McCammon in Des Moines, Iowa.
During the recession, shipping containers began stacking up on American shores. Architects saw an opportunity to recycle them into homes and other spaces. Catherine Welch from member station WRNI found a multi-story office building made entirely from shipping containers.
Several times every day, passenger trains travel through Providence, Rhode Island, passing a Smurf blue building with a shock of yellow and green. It looks like it's made from Legos and often grabs the attention of riders zipping past.
When Amtrak goes by, it's a little event, and they look up from their computer and watch it go by.
Peter Case owns and helped design the building, made entirely from cargo shipping containers, those steel rectangular boxes on trucks and trains. The three-story complex is divided into two sets of offices with a canopy made from the sides of containers covering an exposed central hallway.
our mantra was, let the container be a container whenever possible. So we don't hide the dings.
Dings and all, the building cost $1.8 million. That's half the cost of his original plans for a conventional building, plans he scrapped when the economy tanked. There was no precedent in the U.S., so Case had to convince Providence officials, who were a little hesitant at first. Then he bought shipping containers for $2,000 a pop and welded two or three of them together, cutting out the sides to create an open floor plan.
So this unit is just finished getting the sheetrock on. So you can see, if you look out to go to the very end, that there's all glass.
It feels like any other office space. It took Case and his team 6 months to design and figure out the basics, like installing windows, electric, and plumbing. It took just 4 days to truck in the containers and plunk them down on site. The building's now open for business. Website consultant Chris Murray is the first renter. He recognized it from a Craigslist ad and had to check it out.
We decided to come here because it is really a unique and neat place.
This office in Providence isn't the only building made from containers. There are homes and art studios sprinkled around the U.S., a school in Mexico, and one nonprofit is turning containers into health clinics for poor and rural countries. They may be portable and look cool, but builder Joshua Brandt says don't expect to start seeing them everywhere.
If building with containers was like a fundamentally superior way to build things, people would build out of containers all the time. And the reason why they don't is because it is very challenging.
And for Brandt, it's a relief to get back to normal construction jobs. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch in Providence, Rhode Island.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is in Afghanistan. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Another one of President Obama's top economic advisors is leaving the administration. Larry Summers, head of the National Economic Council, will rejoin the faculty of Harvard University after the November midterm elections. His departure was announced by the White House yesterday, and NPR economics correspondent John Itstead joins us to talk about what it means. Good morning, John.
Hi, Linda.
So, John, Summers was one of the chief architects of the president's economic policies, which are getting a lot of criticism these days. Is this a here's your hat, what's your hurry kind of situation?
No one I've talked to suggests that he's being forced to leave. In fact, Summers had indicated he would leave the administration after 2 years. And when President Obama reappointed Ben Bernanke last summer to be chairman of the Federal Reserve, a job that Summers was said to have been interested in, that probably clinched the deal. I think people were a bit surprised by the timing of the announcement coming before the election instead of after. And one administration insider I talked to suggested maybe Summers announced his departure before the election in order to avoid being made a scapegoat if the election goes badly for Democrats.
Well, you can imagine a situation where after the election, the president would decide to shake up his economic team and go in a different direction. The budget chief, Peter Orszag, is gone. Christine Romer, who chaired the Council of Economic Advisers, is gone. With Summers gone, that just leaves Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner from the original team. Is this really a shakeup?
I don't think it's an intentional shakeup. All these people appear to have left on their own accord. But given all the controversy over the struggling economy, President Obama may be happy to have the chance to reshape his team.
It looks as I would say that Summers certainly would have to take a good deal of responsibility or credit or whatever for the administration's policies.
Absolutely. He was deeply involved in shaping the controversial stimulus package, for instance. Now, some economists argue it saved the U.S. economy from a depression. But of course, Republicans especially argue it was a waste of money. Summers was also architect of the auto industry bailout and one of the architects of the financial reform package, which again are viewed as successes by some and bad policy by others. President Obama offered his opinion yesterday in the White House statement announcing Summers' departure. He said, we are on a better path, thanks in no small measure to Larry's wise counsel.
He did have a reputation, Larry Summers, for being abrasive or arrogant. Do you think that that got in the way of what he was trying to do for the president?
Well, being head of the National Economic Council may not have been the best fit for Summers. It's supposed to be an honest broker for policies going to the president. And sources say Summers was often more interested in promoting his own ideas than those of others.
Who replaces him?
There's reports President will name a business person to try to repair relations with the business community, which has complained they don't have a voice in the White House. One name being circulated is Anne Mulcahy, former CEO of Xerox.
Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome, Linda.
NPR's John Itzde.
Okay, the economic recovery may be slow in much of the country, but in Seattle, at least one industry is booming. It's a cluster of nonprofit organizations working in the field of global health. Many Seattle residents are still learning what that term means, even as the field has sparked a building boom. For member station KPLU in Seattle, Keith Seinfeld has the story.
When you enter the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute, everything is spacious, new, and modern, from the lobby to the shiny and clean laboratories upstairs. It's nothing like back in the 1970s, when founder Ken Stewart came to Seattle. Then he was towing his research lab.
It was a 4x6 U-Haul trailer, literally. I drove from Florida, dragged that trailer.
He borrowed some money, some furniture, and set up his new two-man institute.
It's been described as a strip mall that was next to a gas station in Issaquah. And we had to build our own lab benches.
From those lowly beginnings in a quiet suburb, he now finds himself in command of 330 scientists and staff in some of the finest laboratories in the country, including this airtight breeding room for mosquitoes. The whoosh of fans adds extra security to keep any stray mosquitoes from escaping. It's like being inside a bright, white, stinky sauna. The mosquitoes are reared in trays of water, and they swarm inside cardboard containers that look like ice cream tubs with mesh over the top.
When the Gates Foundation started up, that's when I decided we needed to build a malaria vaccine program. And now there's about 100 people working on malaria, and we're now moving vaccines into clinical trials. So that program has been very successful.
Seattle Biomed is also studying other infectious diseases. That's a big part of what global health is. And not just at Seattle Biomed. A number of local nonprofits are tackling diseases using money from the Gates Foundation. The foundation is a giant force across the globe. It gives out grants to organizations and even governments, totaling about $2 to $3 billion a year. The foundation has stayed in the background in Seattle until now.
If you stand at the heart of the Gates Foundation's new campus under construction here in the center of Seattle, right under the shadow of the Space Needle, one word comes to mind: big.
So this is Building A, and this is Building B.
Lisa Verhovic is giving me a tour. The site is a full 12 acres right on the edge of downtown. 600 construction workers are welding, pouring concrete, even building a pond.
What's happened is that we've just grown very quickly over the last 3 to 5 years. So this campus was needed really to accommodate the size of the foundation now.
There are over 800 employees and counting. The campus also includes a conference and banquet center. Because the Gates Foundation is such a center of influence, there's a constant flow of dignitaries. You can stand on the roof and see other nonprofits in their new buildings. Washington Governor Chris Gregoire is calling global health a local industry, and at a recent conference, an economic path to the future.
It's an industry that is growing, and so if I want to be selfish, I can talk about the fact it's creating amazing jobs.
Now, the governor did add this disclaimer.
You know, I don't want to make you think that it's only about money for us or about jobs.
The humanitarian side of the work is important, too, she says. Steve Gloyd has taken part in that humanitarian work in Africa for 30 years. He also teaches global health at the University of Washington in Seattle.
It's a dream to be able to have this many people interested in the kind of things that have been ignored for decades.
Suddenly, this work is all the buzz, which means getting used to how saving the world also can be a growth industry at home. For NPR News, I'm Keith Seinfeld in Seattle.
Now, if you'd like to explore the world of global health, NPR and KPLU have launched a new blog with a new word here that you can get your brain around, humanosphere. You can learn more at npr.org.